If a man does not make new acquaintances as he advances through life, he will soon find himself alone. A man should keep his friendships in constant repair. It matters not how a man dies, but how he lives. The act of dying is not of importance. It lasts so short a time. Wine makes a man more pleased with himself. I do not say it makes him more pleasing to others. Those are just a few of the sayings attributed to Dr. Samuel Johnson. I'm Emily Auerbach.
I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air.
Samuel Johnson is a towering figure in English literature, an 18th century poet, storyteller, lexicographer, essayist, biographer, literary critic, and moralist, whose colorful life was made famous by James Boswell. Over 300 years after his birth, what is the importance of Samuel Johnson today? What are his major works and themes? How, in an era before computers, did he manage to construct a massive dictionary with over 40,000 entries? Joining us to explore the life and work of Samuel Johnson is Howard Weinbrot, professor of English at the UW-Madison and the author of numerous books on Samuel Johnson, Alexander Pope, and 18th century culture and classical context.
Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you.
Now, if I remember right from Johnson's own dictionary, he defined himself, i.e. a lexicographer, as a harmless drudge. And yet Johnson has one of the most colorful personalities in all of 18th century literature. There's this image of him walking home late at night after an evening of, socializing, and he had to touch every lamppost on the way back home. What kind of a man was Johnson?
An extraordinary man. In the dictionary definition, of course, he is having fun with himself, which he very much earned, because there are approximately 3.5 million words and 43,000 – I'm sorry, approximately 3.5 million total words and approximately 43,000 definitions and 115,000 illustrative quotations. And after all that, someone has earned the right to have a little bit of fun at his own expense. We don't know the real reason for all the touching, but there's a reasonable guess that he had Tourette's syndrome, which would have explained some of his mumbling under his breath, some of his compulsion, some of his tics, and a variety of other kinds of fairly unpleasant ways of dealing with people in public.
For somebody who was so dependent, as Emily quoted, on human interaction, isn't he quoted as saying in some gathering, "Why do you laugh, sir? Have I said something you understood?"
Well, I don't remember that specific context, but he certainly was capable of putting people down. And entire books have been written, or rather taken from his remarks about insults. He is very good at insults, but he's also very good at apologizing for his insults and equally good at making clear that the insult was an outburst rather than a particular attack. And so in this particular case, he may well have felt that the person was simply talking nonsense. But he himself loved to laugh. Johnson was very much engaged with the public, very much engaged in the public sense as a speaker, as a conversationalist. And one of his objections when he met with John Wesley on many occasions, whom he very much admired, was that Wesley does not sit with me for a long enough period of time. He always is getting up to go somewhere. And, of course, Wesley was doing charitable works and he was going off to lecture somewhere and going off to do a variety of different sermonizings. And Johnson liked to sit down and talk. But he also liked to dominate the talk. And that's especially clear in Boswell, who is a partial representative. When we read Boswell, we need to be aware that there are many more versions of Johnson out there.
Boswell being his biographer. Right.
Boswell is the biographer and the one who made him so much of his conversation famous, in some cases infamous.
Well, let's take him back to his childhood, because he claimed that he was poor.
Yes.
Is that accurate?
It is accurate. His father, Michael Johnson, who was probably a depressive as well, ran a bookshop in Litchfield. It was only moderately successful. He went around to a variety of places to sell his books, and sometimes he did and sometimes he didn't. But he was not a rich man by any stretch of imagination, though they did have a comfortable house. That was in part because Sarah Ford, Johnson's mother, brought a little bit more money to the marriage than Michael did. They had a second son, Nathaniel, who died when Johnson was very young, and he drops out completely. He's never talked about, and there's some speculation that he may have committed suicide. And again, that is partly the sadness of Michael Johnson, who was distinguished in his town, but nonetheless never rich. And Johnson could afford only 1 year at Oxford, and that was only after they received £40 inheritance from a relative. So yes, they was very poor.
But he became Dr. Johnson.
He became Dr. Johnson, having received two doctorates, an honorary doctorate from Trinity College Dublin, LLD, and a DCL, Doctor of Civil Laws, from Oxford thereafter. The dictionary itself has Samuel Johnson, M.A., and they held up publication of the book until he did receive his honorary M.A. from Oxford, because he was only there for 1 year at Pembroke College before having to leave. But Pembroke still proudly counts him as its, if not its premier, certainly one of its premier alums. George Whitfield, the Calvinist Methodist, was also a distinguished alum.
From what I've read, it sounds as if he was quite a precocious child, which isn't surprising for someone who would go on to become such a man of letters.
I think it's fair to say that he probably, as a child, was a pain in the butt. That's the polite way of doing it. And he was smarter than any of the other kids. He learned his Latin and Greek very, very well. His Latin was probably almost as good as his English, and his English is quite extraordinary. He was a Mozart of the pen. Almost everything that he wrote was almost perfect upon having been written. And one of the comments about his conversation is that he speaks like a book, and that his conversation is in paragraphs and sounds as if it could immediately be turned into a Rambler essay or a discourse of some sort.
You mentioned Mozart, but actually in terms of his lifespan, he's almost exact contemporary of Benjamin Franklin.
That's right. And they did meet on at least one occasion. And they both belonged to a club called Bray's Associate, in which they were obliged to give at least one guinea, which was 21 shillings.
A lot of money.
Per year, yes. And this was in support of blacks within the United Kingdom. And later on, Franklin split with Johnson because he thought Johnson in Taxation, No Tyranny, in which he argued that the Americans had no right to rebel, that they were self-important and essentially they should mind their own manners, and that he said that the American slaves should rebel. And Johnson hated slavery. And part of what Bray's Associates did was try to encourage education of blacks within the United Kingdom, and that would have extended to the colonies as well. And I can talk a little bit about that later because it's an untold episode in Johnson's life. There's one when he went to a university college at one time, I think in 1770, about 1770. And they're all sitting around, usually as in fellows' common room, having too much to drink and toasting this one and toasting that one. And there had been many, many insurrections, which were reported in the Gentleman's Magazine and other places. And when there's a lull in the toasts, Johnson says, "Here's to the next insurrection of the Negroes in the West Indies." And there was probably a dead silence, for a while, because there was just the beginning of the movement to abolish slavery in England. Almost every year that Wilberforce brought it up, it was voted down, voted down, voted down, until it finally passed circa 1829, I think.
Why did he fail at becoming a school teacher, do you think?
I don't think he would have been very good at it because he was so much smarter than the students. That was one thing, and he probably—
A common problem, but maybe not as common as it used to be.
Fair enough. I shouldn't say that. I think it was partly that. It was partly because of his tics and the way in which he dealt with students. And the students were very, very keen on peering on his private life. He was recently married to Elizabeth Porter, who was old enough to be his mother. And David Garrick was one of his students, would peer through the keyhole and watch him awkwardly embracing his wife. And I don't think he liked that. And there was the very real sense of somebody who was probably not made out to be a teacher, who needs to be tolerant of students' failures.
And how does he then support himself? Or does Samuel Johnson go at a fairly early age into print?
1737, he goes to London, and he writes to Edward Cave, who had just founded what was called the Gentleman's Magazine. It was, in ways, an early version of a Reader's Digest. And he would take essays and portions from other magazines and put them into his own magazine. He would have news of those who lived and died, those who got promoted. But he also would publish poetry and would have current events and would have political matters as well. And Johnson wrote to him and said, "I think I can make your Gentleman's Magazine better. Why don't you hire me?"
Why not?
And "why not" indeed was Cave's response. And he did hire this young man. And then later in the 1740s, he had him write what were called parliamentary debates. And it was illegal at the time to make any recordings of what happened in Parliament. And so Johnson would hang around outside of Westminster, you know, pick up a little bit of this and a little bit of that. And then he would have mock names for each of the speakers, because it would have been a violation of privilege to mention Mr. So-and-so or Lord So-and-so who made such and such speech. But he knew the approximate topic. And so he would invent these wonderful speeches for them. And he said at one time that he heard someone praising Lord Chesterfield's speech as being the equal of Cicero. And Johnson said, "Sir, I wrote that in a garret." And after it was clear, Johnson was so keen on the necessity for truth, after it was clear that people were taking these as if they really were spoken by somebody else, he stopped writing. He said, "That would be a violation of the nature of my relationship to the reader, because I need them to believe, even if this is anonymous, I need them to believe that what I am saying is true."
And if he had been asked at this point, you know, "What is your job?" would he have said a hack writer?
Probably. Or, yeah. A man of letters. Mm-hmm. And this is one of the things that distinguishes Johnson, I think, from somebody like Jonathan Swift, whom he admired but mistrusted, in part because of Swift's attempt to see that he was the only virtuous person in the world. When Johnson writes his Lives of Pope and of Swift, he says some harsh things about them, and in part because he said, when you read the letters between Pope and Swift, they behave as if they're the only virtuous persons in the world, as if they have a monopoly on it. And Johnson doesn't like that, and he doesn't like it in part because he thinks part of his job as a writer is to help you be more virtuous and to help all of his readers be more virtuous to what degree he can. When he writes the Lives of the Poets, he says, I have written these in hopes of inducing and increasing piety.
And speaking of piety, he's an Anglican?
He's an Anglican.
How does that come through in his writing?
Well, it comes through in a variety of ways. One, he's wrote at least 28 sermons. And this is still an understudied aspect of his life and career. People thought that he was a clergyman called Dr. Johnson, but these were no civil degrees. His friend John Taylor asked him to write these for him, and Johnson wrote them, and some of the people listening to them, as soon as they heard Taylor opened his mouth, said, "That's not Taylor, that's Samuel Johnson." And they're wonderful sermons filled with encouragement, filled with a kind of love for human beings, in part because of our fallibility, but refusing to give up on them. And this is both Christian in general and an aspect of what is probably his lower church Anglicanism. Johnson's religion, I think, has been much misunderstood. He's thought of as being a bigoted high church Tory, and he is much more generous than those labels tend to suggest.
Is there a sample you could share with us that, I don't know, captures his what you see as the quintessential Johnson voice?
I would prefer to say quintessential Johnsonian voices. And that is certainly one of the things that I would like to do. When I write about Johnson, when I teach Johnson, part of what I try to encourage is the sense of complexity in Johnson. And if you like, I can read a poem that is rarely anthologized but is going to be in the anthology that I'm doing with my colleagues Robert DeMaria and Steve Fix for Yale of Johnson, what we hope will revolutionize Johnsonian studies. One of the things that Johnson insists upon is recognizing the extraordinary anger and hostility within the human mind, what Freud would probably call the id, but nonetheless the need to discipline it. And one of the things that he likes to do is talk about regulate and discipline the human mind. And I'd like to read just briefly two things. One from Johnson's Rambler number 14 on the mind and the ways in which we must always try to succeed even though we fail.
And the Rambler would have been a collection of essays that he edited and wrote?
That he wrote and begins in 1750 and goes on for 208 numbers while he's doing the dictionary, between 1750 and 1752. This is from the Rambler number 8 on Saturday, the 14th of April, 1750. The Ramblers appeared on Tuesdays and Saturdays. How the understanding is best conducted to the knowledge of science, by what steps it is to be led forward in its pursuit, how it is to be cured of its defects and habituated to new studies, has been the inquiry of many acute and learned men, whose observations I shall not either adopt or censure, my purpose being to consider the moral discipline of the mind, and to promote the increase of virtue rather than of learning. This inquiry seems to have been neglected for want of remembering that all action has its origin in the mind, and that therefore to suffer the thoughts to be vitiated is to poison the fountain of morality. Irregular desires will produce licentious practices. What men allow themselves to wish, they will soon believe, and will be at last incited to execute what they please themselves with contriving. But Johnson also knows that so much of this, no matter how good we are, we're very much likely to fail. And so part of what he insists upon is, he says, we are therefore not to wonder that most fail amidst tumult and snares and danger, in the observance of those precepts which they lay down in solitude, safety and tranquility, with a mind unbiased and with liberty unobstructed. It is the condition of our present state to see more than we can attain. The exactest vigilance and caution can never maintain a single day of unmingled innocence, much less can the utmost efforts of incorporated mind reach the summits of speculative virtue. Then it's Johnson's typical but clause. It is, however, necessary for the idea of perfection to be proposed, that we may have some object to which our endeavors are to be directed, and that he that is most efficient in the duties of life makes some atonement for his faults if he warns others against his own failings and hinders by the salubrity of his admonitions the contagion of his example. That is typically Johnsonian. Always aim high. If you fail, do not be down on yourself, but continue to try to succeed.
And to explain to others how you had failed so that they may not.
That's right. And much of those last words, Johnson is almost certainly talking about himself.
I confess I was reminded of the end of one of the most scandalous novels of the 18th century, which was Fanny Hill, which comes to much the same conclusion. After all these wonderful thoughts of Samuel Johnson about the discipline of the human mind, I can't resist asking in a moment about James Boswell, who seemed to have had a very undisciplined mind and yet wrote one of the great biographies of all time about Samuel Johnson. We'll return in a moment. This is University of the Air.
His appetite was so fierce and indulged with such intenseness that the veins of his forehead swelled and generally a strong perspiration was visible. That's from a comment by Boswell about Samuel Johnson. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Howard Weinbrot, and we are celebrating the life and work of Samuel Johnson. I'm sure it must be hard to separate out the full picture of Samuel Johnson from what his famous biographer Boswell left behind, because the biography almost is in some ways more famous than Johnson himself, or at least it sort of competes for our focus. What about the fact that Norman raised at the end of our last segment that Boswell himself had quite a few flaws?
I think that's understating significantly. James Boswell destroyed himself, literally, with a combination of sexual promiscuity and alcohol. And he was certainly an alcoholic, and he was certainly a sexaholic in the same sense. He probably went after every prostitute in all of London. There's one rather sad episode in which he, as a young man, Boswell comes to London and he says, I want to be cured. I don't want to get the clap. I don't want to have venereal disease. Therefore, I'm not going to be with every prostitute around. I'm just going to find myself one nice woman whom I can keep as my mistress, and she will be loyal to me and I'll be clean. And he supports her. He finds her. And then lo and behold, he finds that he has indeed got the clap. And so what does one young Jamie Boswell do? He goes to her and says, I want my money back. And I think she does do that, but that is very typical of Boswell. And there's this one episode in which Johnson and Boswell are walking down the street in London, and Boswell sees a prostitute and tries to go after her, and Johnson hauls him back and says, no, no, sir, it will not do. And obviously he's literally trying to keep Boswell on the straight and narrow, which he could only do when he was in Boswell's
company. Do you suppose
company.
It was almost a Jekyll and Hyde situation, the fondness of one for the other, the two that were so different? I mean, do you suppose Johnson found Boswell appealing in part because he would do these daring things that Johnson was too disciplined to think about?
Probably not. I think there was clearly a father-son relationship, or surrogate father-son relationship, you know, between them. Johnson immediately recognized that Boswell was a young man in search of some kind of anchor. Boswell's father was the equivalent of a Supreme Court judge in Edinburgh, and very, very demanding, very, very Calvinist, very, very stern, and very, very disapproving of Jamie for not being as successful. And Jamie was always trying to live up to his father and never being able to succeed. And so for much of Boswell's life, he looks towards heroes. He tries to meet Rousseau, and he does. He tries to meet Voltaire. And he has an affair with Rousseau's mistress as well, again, as a way of shaking the hand that shook the hand, as it were. And he always is looking for some superior male to whom he can feel ingratiated. And that's almost certainly the relationship that he has with Johnson. He meets Johnson on April 16th. 1763. And from then on, things begin to change. At first, Boswell is put down by Johnson, and he says to Thomas Davies in their shop, sir, no, don't tell him where I'm from. And Davies immediately says, he is from Scotland, to which Boswell says, yes, but I can't help it, sir.
So it's considered second class.
To which Johnson says, sir, that is something many of our countrymen cannot help. And that's a put down, but Boswell refuses to give up on it. And he courts Johnson, goes to visit him, sits on talking with him. And on their second meeting, Johnson shakes Boswell's hand and says, sir, I have taken a liking to you. Come and visit me often.
So there was something mm-hmm. about Boswell. He had some kind of a charm.
He was a very charming young man, and he was able to ingratiate himself with, again, these much more distinguished people. And Boswell would go home and write up his notes when he was sober. Sometimes they would be in small portions. Sometimes he would then go back to them and write them up in fuller episodes. Other times he would write what were called papers apart, and he would write an entire little piece about it, a kind of short story, in effect. And these then become the journals from which he makes the life of Johnson in the late 1780s, in part because his friend Edmund Malone brings him in and sits him down and works with him all the time, because Boswell was too disorganized, too drunk, and too generally dissipated to be able to do that.
Was he actually taking notes, though, Boswell?
No, that's a myth.
It's all from memory during these conversations he'd write later.
Yes.
And did Johnson sort of approve of this biographical endeavor? Did he know that this biography was coming out and that it would be a sort of celebration of his wit and so on?
Later in his life, he did in fact know that, and he may have been performing for Boswell at some time. So when the book appears in 1791, it's expected and it had long been announced, and it becomes a hit in both positive and negative senses. Many people say, you are violating privacy. You have no right to use my letters. You have no right to write in a book what I said in private. And it was really a cause celeb in that sense. But then it also immediately became something that people sat down and read and read and read. And that is one of the reasons why Macaulay, in his famous 11th edition discussion of Johnson, said that we really read Johnson for Boswell and his conversation rather than the works. And for hundreds of years now, Johnsonians have been trying to free Johnson from what we regard as that calumny.
Okay. Well, let's put Boswell aside then and turn to the question of what then would you consider Johnson's major works to be? He wrote so much in so many different genres. If you were asked by someone, you know, I only have time to read one Johnson work, what would you say?
Well, I would probably say read The Lives of the Poets, but that's not one Johnson work. It's three very big volumes. and they're monuments. They're, without question, I think, the best combination of literary criticism and literary theory in the English language and perhaps of any language. They're also biographical monuments. It begins with Cooley and the last one is Gray. And what Johnson does in The Lives of the Poets is survey the beginning of what he thinks of as the polishing of the English language. And when he writes The Life of Cooley, where there's a long section on the metaphysical poets, part of what he does is suggest the way in which early in the 17th century there is this sort of wild, romantic, Baroque kind of quality which is wonderful for learning but is not actually related to human experience. And this gradually deals with Denham and Waller, who polished English prose, to Dryden, who taught us how to be good critics, to Pope, who perfects the English couplet, which Johnson thinks of as being the peak of what the English language can do. He's very suspicious of blank verse, and he is in part because he thinks the English language is very undisciplined and that needs the discipline of the couplet, otherwise it will go off into long, silly paragraphs.
Well, blank verse, though. Isn't most of Shakespeare blank verse? What did Johnson think about Shakespeare?
He thought that Shakespeare was the greatest dramatic poet in the world. but that is Shakespeare. And he thinks that Milton's Paradise Lost is the greatest product of the human intellect. But that is Milton. He's not worried about Shakespeare and Milton. He's worried about the people who imitate Shakespeare and Milton.
Did he, Johnson, if I remember right, he actually did try his hand at fiction. He tried his hand at playwriting, didn't he?
He wrote a drama called Irene, set in Greece about the Turkish and Greek conflict. And it was finally produced by his friend David Garrick, the greatest actor of the 18th century, and also the manager of Drury Lane. And it ran for 9 nights, which was very good, probably because Garrick kept it running. And according to 18th century mores, the author gets the proceeds of the third night. And it had three third nights, which would have been pretty good. So it got Johnson maybe as much as £300. But when Johnson heard it read later in his life, he picked himself up, walked out of the room, and said, "Sir, I thought it had been better."
Well,
and that was, interestingly enough, Irene is in blank verse. And it is bad blank verse because it is very heavily end-stopped, because Johnson really was thinking in terms of the couplet.
Rather than conversation.
Rather than the ongoing movement of blank verse. Yes.
One of the dangers with Johnson and some of the other 18th century writers is they wrote so much that we tend to get snippets in anthologies, so we're very much at the mercy of other people's selections.
Yes.
You mentioned you're working on a new Johnson anthology for Yale, and that you're hoping to kind of change perceptions. Can you give us some sense of what you'll be including that might not be so familiar?
One of the things we'll be including is Johnson's legal brief for the case of Joseph Knight, which Boswell added to the second edition of the biography, but is not really very much read. In 1777, Joseph Knight, who was a Jamaican slave living outside of Edinburgh, had an affair with one of the young white women. They fell very much in love. She got pregnant, and he asked to be able to work off the estate so that he could earn his own money to support his family, an obviously honorable man. And his employer said, no, you may not. You're my slave. He ran away, and he went to court and tried to get himself declared, because he was in Scotland, not in Jamaica, declared a free man. And this case went on for years. In the interim, Knight married his girlfriend, and they had another child who was able to live. Boswell wanted to get Johnson's opinion on it. Johnson and Boswell himself, to his vast discredit, believed in slavery. He thought that slavery was a necessary condition for African blacks. He thought it was a common condition for Europeans up until relatively recently. He thought it was okay, you know, for slavery. Johnson abhorred slavery. And indeed, Johnson's servant, Frank Barber, was a young black boy who was brought to him at the age of 7 by his friend Richard Bathurst. And Johnson raised Barber, left the vast bulk of his estate to Frank Barber as well, educated him, sent him to school at very significant expense. And because of Johnson's hatred of slavery, he wrote this legal brief for Joseph Knight, which was very successful and was read. And Joseph Knight won his case and permanently abolished slavery in Scotland as a result. And this is rarely written about when we think about Johnson, and it's rarely in there. We're going to be including some of Johnson's law briefs as well, and going to include some of his poems that rarely get anthologized also. May I read one?
Oh, sure.
This is, again, relates to the nature of moral discipline that I read earlier. And it's a way in which Johnson recognizes human passions, especially in the young, and especially the sexual passions, but also says, be careful. This is called To Miss on Her Playing on the Harpsichord in a Room Hung with Some Flower Pieces of Her Own Painting. The woman is Alicia Maria Carpenter. And the date of this is probably circa 1730. When Stella struck an image, this of the young, attractive woman sitting in her little room playing on the spinet with the images on the wall, with a handsome young man approaching her. When Stella strikes the tuneful string in scenes of imitated spring, where beauty lavishes her power on beds of never-fading flowers, and pleasure propagates around each charm of modulated sound, ah, think not in the dangerous hour the nymph fictitious as the flower, but shun, rash youth, the gay alcove, nor tempt the snares of wily love. When charms thus press on every sense, what thought of flight or of defense, deceitful hope and vain desire forever flutter o'er her lyre, delighting as the youth drawn nigh to point the glances of her eye, and forming with unerring art new chains to hold the captive heart. But on these regions of delight my truth intrude with daring flight. Could Stella, sprightly, fair, and young, one moment hear the moral song, instruction with her flowers might spring, and wisdom warble from her string. Mark, when from thousand mingled eyes thou seest one pleasing form arise, how active light and thoughtful shade in greater scenes each other aid. Mark, when the different notes agree in friendly contrariety, how passion's well-accorded strife gives all the harmony of life. Thy pictures shall thy conduct frame, consistent still, though not the same. Thy music teach the nobler art to tune the regulated heart. Remember that you are human, not like those up there. You can be seduced, you can fall from grace, but try to do what art does, that is, combine the passion and the color and the energy plus the moral discipline to tune the regulated heart. And this is very, very Johnsonian. We've got to put that in the anthology.
Why does that sound like it should be the title of a biography of Johnson, The Regulated Heart?
That is wonderful, yes. And I might say, by the way, that since last year was the 300th anniversary of his birth, there were three biographies, new biographies that came out. I won't comment on them because two of them I think are not very good and one is pretty good. But they have not said a great deal new. But at Pembroke College during the 300th anniversary celebration, Andrew Teal, the Anglican priest who was attached to Pembroke, announced in the chapel what apparently none of these biographers knew and none of us knew. On December 5th, 2005, Samuel Johnson was made a minor saint in the Church of England. And all the biographers' jaws dropped. Everybody's jaw dropped.
Quick footnote.
Exactly. And somewhere along the line, there's a paper trail in Lambeth Palace, which I want to track down to find out how this worked. Because if you're like me, you didn't know that the Anglican Church had saints, minor or major.
Of their own, right, yeah.
The Catholic Church certainly has. You have to go through a certain series and you need to have certain kinds of miracles that have been proven. The Anglicans don't do that. And so we cannot say Saint Sam, but nonetheless, he's saintly for many of his friends.
Yeah. One of the places that I've encountered references to Johnson is in the novel Jane Eyre, where Helen Burns is reading Rasselas, and it's this idea of being resigned to suffering. I think it's the line, human life is everywhere a state in which much is to be endured and little to be enjoyed. Sort of life is this thing you just get through. What can you say about Rasselas, this allegorical tale that he wrote?
Rasselas is a wonderful tale. It has been translated into virtually every European language. And at Pembroke, one of the things that a Chinese visitor said was that he was now in the process of translating it into Chinese. It's been translated into Japanese, I'm sure, and probably into Hindi, because Johnson is known in India as well. That's only part of what goes on in Rasselas. Part of what Johnson is so good at is what is called wisdom literature. And part of his wisdom is to include the endurance of life and accept it as part of the reality, but also saying that it's only a part of life. His life was filled with joy in many, many cases. And what Rasselas is about is how young Prince Rasselas has everything possible, everything that anybody could want, enjoyment of the senses, enjoyment of everything. In Abyssinia, in the Happy Valley, he's part of a royal family, and he's X number in the succession. But he's bored to death. Absolutely bored. And finally, he meets a teacher called Imlac. He hears him reciting a poem upon the joys of life and the difficulties of life. And young Rasselas says, oh, good, now I have something to wish for. I can find out what misery is like. And he gets involved with Imlac. He speaks with Imlac. Imlac begins to teach him and says, I can get out of here anytime I want. Really? Yes, show me how. And he says, we are going to dig through the mountain. And as they're digging through the mountain, his sister, Nakaya, comes along and says, may I join you, please? Mm-hmm. And Nakaya also wants to get out. And she brings along her maid, Pekowa. And the three of them finally get out, investigate the world. And there, for these wonderful young people, guided by Imlac, they begin to find out what the world is like. And one of the things they find is that there is indeed a good deal of suffering. But they also find that in spite of the suffering, human beings endure and keep on going and keep on trying to find something better. And they go through these various choices of life, most of which they find have a form of inadequacies attached to them. But they never stop looking. And by the time they come to the end, the last chapter heading of Rasselas is the conclusion in which nothing is concluded. And not because something is concluded. What is concluded is that you never conclude. And though they decide to go back to Abyssinia, they also know that they're going to continue to look for a better way of life. The very interesting thing, at the same time, 1759, was when Voltaire's Candide appeared.
I heard Candide coming right there. And Candide was actually was he not responding to, or was the book not responding to that sentiment expressed by Alexander Pope, whatever is right, and this is the best of all possible worlds, it tends to come through the works of,
yes,
of
and,
Pope.
And of the appalling Lisbon
earthquake of 1755.
So many people died. And the argument is the best of all possible worlds, and Voltaire says, oh, yeah. No, try to explain that with your theology, if you please. Johnson didn't much like Voltaire. He thought that he was a mile wide and an inch deep and thought that his literary criticism was superficial.
And did the two works, Candide and Rasselas, come out at the same time without influencing each other?
Without influencing one another. And they're commonly and still are, you know, talked about in terms of the very, very big differences between them. Voltaire's Candide ends with, what we all must do is simply cultivate our own gardens. That is, stay put. To which Johnson would say, no, you need to be out in the world to be able to grow and to be able to be engaged with the world, whatever degree you can. In the nature of things, you will fail. But the only real failure is to stop trying to succeed.
And what about the 9-year project of putting together that dictionary? I guess, you know, what do you think is Johnson's major contribution to the English language by doing that project, and how did it affect him as a writer to have done all those entries?
Up until before that, when he did the Ramblers, he was known as Mr. Rambler. Right after the dictionary appears, he immediately is called Dictionary Johnson. And this is because it's a commercial success, and it's two big folio volumes that were quite extraordinary. He was paid £1,575 by a consortium of booksellers. In about the third year, he begins to run out of money, and because he was supporting six amanuenses, six people who helped him to write it, though by and large he did it himself. And the bookseller said, sorry, we're not giving you any more money. That's the contract. Which Johnson said, sorry, I'm not working until you pay me more money. He, in effect, went on strike. And so they did give him more money. And then as a result, the book was published on the fateful day, April 15th, 1755, much better for the English language than the American taxpayer. And I think part of what that does is not only establish Johnson as the major lexicographic figure, certainly before the Oxford English Dictionary, but also does remarkable things for the nature of lexicography in general. The continental lexicographers already had worked in a way in which they could break down definitions and give illustrations. That was unusual in English lexicography. Most English lexicography before that simply gave a word and gave a definition. In many cases, they were definitions of what they called hard words, words taken from Greek or Latin or Hebrew or medical terms or farming terms that would not be in the normal discourse. Johnson's dictionary is a dictionary of literary English, and he says very clearly in the preface to the dictionary that I hope to make the genius of Hooker, of Shakespeare, of Milton known to the English people. And quite remarkably, one can pick up almost any page of Johnson's dictionary and read it for pleasure. And that sounds weird, because nobody goes to a dictionary to read for pleasure. You look up the word to see how to spell it or what it means. But as a result of Johnson's illustrative quotations, they are all very, very much part of an educational process that Johnson does in virtually everything that he's trying to do. And you remember the beginning of Vanity Fair, Becky Sharp throws out Johnson's dictionary. But she was not throwing out a folio. She was throwing out a smaller version of it, an octavo. And it becomes, in many ways, a symbol of the attempt to standardize English. And there is a debate among lexicographers and Johnsonians about whether Johnson was being prescriptive or descriptive.
Oh, yes.
He says, and I think he's right, that he's being descriptive. When he writes the plan of the dictionary in 1747, dedicated to Chesterfield, Lord Chesterfield, he says, I would like to fix the language. As he's working on this, he realizes this is impossible, that the English language is so unruly. It is so filled with neologisms. It is so filled with foreigners coming in, making up new words, with new crafts being...
Rather like today.
Rather indeed, like today, who would have talked about pixels or cell phones or anything like that? And he's very much aware of the nature of language. And then as he moves along in the preface to the dictionary, which is a great, great document, a very personal document, as so much of Johnson's writing is, he says, I once thought that I could fix the language, and that is now quite impossible. I realize that's the dreams of a poet doomed to wake a lexicographer. And he said, the best I can hope to do is to repel the collapse of the language and at least hold up some standards. And the Johnson, the dictionary is revised in 1773. He adds a good deal more. He adds some things. He writes a different small preface for it as well.
Final thoughts about Samuel Johnson when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest Howard Weinbrot. And in these last few minutes of our conversation about Samuel Johnson, I can't resist asking, you know, you've been teaching how many hundreds of students perhaps about Samuel Johnson over the years. What have you seen in terms of the effect he's actually had on them?
In many cases, it's been quite profound. And as any teacher knows, the influence you have on your students very often comes far later, and you don't know the influence that you've had on them. One of my favorites is when I was at the Century Supermarket some time ago, and I was just checking out, and there was a young woman there, and she said, oh, Professor Weinbrot, you don't remember me, but I had your Johnson course 4 or 5 years ago. And I said, I'm sorry, I don't, but I hope you enjoyed it. And her face lit up, and she said, it saved my marriage.
Now, that surprises me. What about Johnson that would have saved her marriage?
Well, it may have been the passage on marriage in Rasselas, where Johnson talks about the ways in which early marriage and late marriage work and the ways in which one must have a tolerance within marriage and the way in which one must always be able to accept failure while working towards success. I'm guessing at that. A late uncle of mine who was a psychoanalyst heard me many years ago when I was in graduate school blathering on about Johnson, finally got bored and said, no, shut up. You talk about Rasselas. Let me read this book. And my uncle's specialty was marital disharmony. After World War II, he and a colleague, in effect, invented that discipline. It did not exist in psychoanalysis. And when I saw him, whenever it was, some months later, he said, this man knows more about marriage than it took me 25 years to learn. And, you know, psychiatrists have been very much attracted to Johnson because of his ability to understand how the human mind works, its strengths and its weakness. Once I was teaching Rasselas also, because Rasselas ultimately is about the need to continue to search and the vanity of human wishes, no matter how high your hopes, they're likely to be disappointed. And just as after teaching Rasselas, I said to the class, which I usually do, and it terrifies them, and I said, did you like it? Because they don't think they're supposed to like it. They're supposed to read it. And I heard this enormous sigh coming from the back. And I said, what's that? She said, if only my sister in Waukesha could have read this. And those kinds of experiences work. And one student, when I said, we're going to be dealing with a dictionary preface at our next meeting, and I'd like you to read Johnson's letter to Chesterfield about that, in which Chesterfield tries to take credit for the dictionary, and Johnson puts him down as an inadequate patron. And the student said, I was waiting for the bus, reading my book, and a man was peering over my shoulder. And he said, oh, what are you reading there, sonny? And he said, well, I'm reading someone named Samuel Johnson writing a letter to some guy named Chesterfield. At which point the man standing next to him proceeded to recite the entire letter verbatim.
Wow.
Dr. Johnson would be so proud.
Johnson would have been very, very pleased to have put down his lordship.
And what about on a personal level? Is there a passage or a moment in Johnson that sort of got you hooked?
I was immediately attracted as an undergraduate to Johnson, first through Boswell, when I found Johnson puzzling but enormously attractive as an intellectual energy and his way of engaging in debate. But then also with The Vanity of Human Wishes, which is Johnson's adaptation of Juvenal, the Roman satirist's 10th satire, but an improvement on it in moral terms. And part of what it does in the beginning is point out the enormous dangers at work in the world. The Vanity of Human Wishes is a kind of Rasselas, where he deals with different categories of how human beings aspire and how we very often harm ourselves by means of those aspirations, whether they're military, whether they're personal, whether they're beautiful, or whatever. The world is a dangerous place out there.
And this is his most famous
this
poem?
This is his most famous poem, and a very great poem about which T.S. Eliot was very keen. And it begins with the need to be empirical. Let observation with extensive view survey mankind from China to Peru. Remark each anxious toil, each eager strife, and watch the busy scenes of crowded life. Then say how hope and fear, desire and hate, o'erspread with snares the clouded maze of fate, where wavering man betrayed by venturous pride to tread the dreary paths without a guide, as treacherous phantoms in the mist delude, shuns fancied ills or chases airy good, how rarely reason guides the stubborn choice, rules the bold hand, or prompts the suppliant voice. This is so typical of Johnson. Look, 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 draw the inferences, and don't be out there without a guide. That is a very typical Johnsonian mode. You cannot make in the world alone. You need help. At the end of the poem, after we have seen everything collapse, even the apparently innocent wish when a mother says, I'd like to have an attractive daughter, and she winds up being seduced and abandoned. At that point, the reader breaks into the poem and says, where then shall hope and fear their objects find? Must dull suspense corrupt the stagnant mind? Must helpless man in ignorance sedate roll darkling down the torrent of his fate? Must no dislike alarm, no wishes rise, no cries attempt the mercies of the skies? Johnson then answers those questions. Inquirer, cease. Petitions yet remain, which heaven may hear, nor deem religion vain. Still raise for good the supplicating voice, but leave to heaven the measure and the choice, safe in his power, whose eyes discern afar the secret ambush of a specious prayer. Then it goes down to the end and says, these goods for man the laws of heaven ordain, these goods he grants who grants the power to gain. With these celestial wisdom calms the mind and makes the happiness she does not find. And this goes back to Emily's quotation from Jane Eyre. You can may not find happiness, but you can make it. And the moving quality of this is whether or not one is Christian in a sense, for Johnson is demonstrably not irrelevant, is urgent, is morally urgent, is theologically urgent. But for the human being, just knowing that Johnson is there as a guide is a matter of extraordinary comfort for many people. In his Life of Savage, Savage thought that he was, 1744, thought that he was the illegitimate son of the Countess of Macclesfield and the Earl Rivers, and he and Johnson wander the streets. Everybody in Life of Savage either dies or abandons Savage, with the exception of Johnson, who is always there guiding him and then concludes by guiding the reader by saying about Savage, if you think you're much better in your better condition, do not think that. Just think about how brave Savage was coping with what he did and learn from that.
And our guide through just a little bit of the writing and a little bit of the life of Samuel Johnson has been Howard Weinbrot. A pleasure it has been.
It's been a pleasure to be here. Thank you very much, sir.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach. I hope you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Air.